Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
The image of George Washington is, well, it's as solid as the stone of Mount Rushmore, isn't it?
It really is.
He's that stoic face on our dollar bill, the iconic father of the nation. But what if we told you that behind that familiar, almost unyielding visage lies a far more intricate and, frankly, human story, one filled with paradoxes, struggles, and an evolution that profoundly shaped a nation?
It's true. We tend to view figures like Washington as, you know, fully formed right from the start, just destined for greatness.
Right.
But what's truly fascinating is tracing the path of a man who was constantly learning, constantly adapting, and grappling with these immense challenges. He wasn't born into the role of national leader. He was forged by a lifetime of, well, personal struggles, strategic blunders even, and profound lessons that often came the hard way.
Exactly. And that's really our mission in this deep dive, to take a fresh look at George Washington. We've pulled together a really rich stack of sources, articles, research, historical notes, to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge for you. Mm-hmm. We want to go beyond the myth, you know, to understand the pivotal moments, the personal challenges, and the lasting impact of this incredible figure. We'll explore his journey from a young surveyor in colonial Virginia all the way to the first president of the United States, unearthing surprising facts and, yeah, just enough humor to keep you hooked on his extraordinary story.
And you'll gain a thorough understanding of not just what he did, but why it mattered and how those decisions, those actions continue to resonate in American life today.
Yeah.
We'll unpack his early life, his often tumultuous military career, his reluctant but absolutely essential step into political leadership.
Reluctant is a good word for it.
Definitely. The groundbreaking precedents he set as president and his complex, evolving views on really critical issues like slavery and Native American relations. It's a story of constant learning and adaptation. #, early life and formative years, 1732, 1752.
Okay, let's unpack this right from the beginning then. George Washington was born on February 22, 1732. Though, you know, calendar systems were a bit fluid back then. Some records actually put it as February 11th, 1731, under the old style calendar. Bit confusing.
Right, the dating difference always trips people up.
Yeah. His birthplace was Pope's Creek in Westmoreland County, Virginia, very much a part of British America at the time. He was the first of 6 children for Augustine and Mary Ball Washington.
And his father, Augustine, he was a justice of the peace, a pretty prominent public figure in the community.
And George also had 4 older half-siblings from Augustine's first marriage. So a substantial family, even if, you know, not all under one roof from day one.
And this family dynamic, it offers an early glimpse into his character, I think. While he rarely mentioned his father in later years, which suggests their relationship wasn't particularly close.
Interesting.
And his relationship with his mother was reportedly quite fractious, let's say. Mm-hmm. He developed this remarkably strong bond with his older half-brother, Lawrence.
Yeah, Lawrence.
And that connection would prove incredibly influential, almost defining the trajectory of his early life, especially when you consider Lawrence's ambitions and his connections.
Yeah, a real pivot point in his youth, it sounds like. The family moved around a bit, first to Little Hunting Creek in 1735, which of course would later become Mount Vernon.
That's right.
And then they settled at Ferry Farm near Fredericksburg in 1738. But the most significant personal turning point, as you mentioned, came in 1743 with Augustine's untimely death.
Yeah, a huge blow.
Which meant young George, at just 11 years old, missed out on that formal kind of elite education in England that his elder half-brothers, like Lawrence, had received. places like Appleby Grammar School. He wasn't on that traditional path for a Virginia gentleman.
And that forced him onto a different path, a more practical one, and arguably, you could say, a more valuable educational trajectory for what was to come.
True.
Instead, he attended a lower church school in Hartfield. And there, his focus wasn't on Latin or the classics, but squarely on mathematics and land surveying.
Practical skills.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This hands-on vocational training was a game changer. He became an incredibly talented draftsman and map maker, skills that would serve him throughout his entire life. Ron Chernow, his biographer, even noted that his early adult writing possessed considerable force and precision.
Wow.
Yeah, a testament to his self-driven learning and that practical mind. And here's a fascinating little nugget. As a teenager, he meticulously copied out the rules of civility.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about those.
Over 100 maxims for social interaction, copied from an English translation of a French guidebook. It's a powerful window into his early self-discipline and his profound aspirations for social grace and respectability. He was actively crafting himself, you know.
He really was like a self-help guru before the term even existed. And his early career ambitions, they were heavily influenced, maybe even accelerated, by the Fairfax family.
Absolutely crucial connection.
He frequently visited Belvoir, the grand plantation of William Fairfax. And Fairfax wasn't just Lawrence's father-in-law. He became Washington's patron and sort of a surrogate father figure. Mm. That connection was invaluable. It opened doors that might otherwise have been closed to a young man without that formal British education. You see this almost immediately when he spent a month in 1748, at only 16, surveying Fairfax's huge Shenandoah Valley property.
16?
Yeah.
That's incredible. And that experience, it just quickly propelled him into a formal career. In 1749, he secured a surveyor's license from the College of William and Mary.
Right.
And here's a surprising fact. There's zero evidence he actually attended classes there.
Get out. Really?
Yeah. His practical skills demonstrated on that Fairfax survey trip were apparently enough. Building on that connection, Thomas Fairfax, William's cousin and a major landowner, then appointed him surveyor of Culpeper County, Virginia, in July 1749.
A big deal for someone so young.
Huge deal. Especially since he hadn't served the customary apprenticeship. It speaks volumes about the trust placed in him and, well, the influence of his patrons. Though he resigned the post in 1750, by 1752, at just 20 years old, he had already bought almost 1,500 acres in the Shenandoah Valley. That brought his total land ownership to an impressive 2,315 acres.
Wow, at 20?
It demonstrates a very early, very aggressive pursuit of land and wealth. Really laying the groundwork for his future as a substantial planter.
A true entrepreneurial spirit, even as a teenager. Now, for a unique personal experience, his one and only trip abroad, that happened in 1751.
Right, to Barbados.
He accompanied Lawrence there, hoping the warmer climate would cure his brother's tuberculosis. It must have been a poignant journey, you know, a final act of brotherly devotion.
Yeah. Heartbreaking, really.
And while there, Washington himself contracted smallpox, left his face slightly scarred, a common thing back then, but still a personal mark he carried.
And sadly, Lawrence's health didn't improve. He died in 1752.
Which left a void in George's life, but also kind of opened a path forward, didn't it? Washington initially leased the beloved Mount Vernon estate from Lawrence's widow, Anne, before eventually inheriting it outright after her death in 1761. These early losses and experiences, from his father to his beloved half-brother, they truly shaped his character and his resolve. You can see that. #, #, colonial military career, 1752, 1758.
They absolutely did. That personal connection to Lawrence, especially Lawrence's prior military service as adjutant general of the Virginia militia, that directly inspired George to seek his own commission.
Ah, okay, so it wasn't just ambition, it was family example, too.
Right, it wasn't just about following in footsteps, it was about seeking the status and, frankly, the opportunity that military service offered in colonial Virginia. And Virginia's lieutenant governor, Robert Dinwiddie, he recognized the young man's ambition and his family's standing. Mm-hmm. So he appointed Washington as a major and commander of one of the colony's four militia districts. Now, this was happening against a really volatile backdrop, intense British and French competition for control of the Ohio River Valley.
All right, the flashpoint.
Exactly. Both sides were actively constructing forts in disputed territory. The region was basically a powder keg, and, well, Washington was about to light the fuse.
And he found himself, a young guy, just 21, right in the thick of it. In October 1753, Dinwiddie appointed Washington as a special envoy.
Mm-hmm. A crucial mission.
His mission was twofold. traveled deep into the Ohio Valley to demand that French forces vacate land claimed by the British, and crucially, to gather intelligence about their military strength and intentions. It was a perilous diplomatic mission, really.
Extremely perilous.
And during this journey, he met with the Iroquois leader Tanakerison at Logstown, who gave Washington this rather ominous but intriguing name, Conodocarius.
Devourer of villages.
Yeah, meaning devourer of villages, a name previously given to his great-grandfather. A powerful, maybe even prophetic title for a budding military figure.
It's quite a significant name to inherit, isn't it? Reflects a deep history and a certain gravitas, even then. Washington's party, after a really difficult journey, finally reached the Ohio River in November 1753. They were intercepted and escorted to Fort Lebeuf,
okay,
where he delivered the British demand to the French commander, Jacques Lagarde de Saint-Pierre. Unsurprisingly, the French commander politely, but very firmly, refused to leave.
Can't say I blame him.
No. But despite that diplomatic setback, Washington successfully completed this incredibly precarious mission in harsh winter conditions, documenting every detail. His report was then published in both Virginia and London.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, brought him considerable distinction and public attention very early in his career. He proved himself capable, you know, of executing a difficult task under immense pressure.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting and where we see that intense learning curve of his early military career. Just a few months later, February 1754, Dinwiddie, clearly impressed by that previous mission, promoted Washington to lieutenant colonel, second in command, and made him second in command of the 300-strong Virginia regiment. Their orders were explicit. Confront the French at the forks of the Ohio, where Fort Duquesne was rapidly being built. This wasn't just reconnaissance anymore. This was a clear directive for military action.
And this is where a series of events unfolded that would almost unwittingly ignite a global conflict. It's really quite extraordinary. In May 1754, Washington established a defensive position at Great Meadows, a natural clearing.
Right.
He then received intelligence of a French camp nearby and made the fateful decision to take the offensive. On May 28, he led an ambush against a French detachment of about 50 men.
Okay, so he strikes first.
He does. And in the ensuing skirmish, the French commander, Joseph Coulon de Jumonville, and many of his men were killed. The French, understandably furious, later found their countrymen dead and scalped, placing the blame squarely on Washington. He then hastily retreated to Fort Necessity, which was a hastily constructed, pretty ill-sited defense.
And things just kept getting more complicated, didn't they? It really reveals the chaotic nature of colonial military command back then. He was then promoted to colonel and given command of the full regiment, but almost immediately faced a command conflict with Captain James Mackay of the South Carolinians. Mackay held a royal commission, which, under British policy, outranked Washington's colonial one.
Ah, the rank issue. Classic problem.
Exactly. This tension, this inherent inferiority of colonial officers, was a bitter pill for him to swallow. Then, on July 3 at Fort Necessity, Washington's forces were attacked by some 900 French soldiers and their Native American allies.
Overwhelming force.
Leading to his first and only surrender. And here's the truly infamous part. Because he didn't speak French and later blamed his translator, Washington unwittingly signed a surrender document that took responsibility for the assassination of Jumonville.
Oof. Assassination is a strong word.
Right. That single, unfortunate incident is widely considered to have ignited the French and Indian War, which quickly spiraled into the global Seven Years' War. After this humiliation and facing that British policy that colonials couldn't rank higher than captain, he refused the demotion and resigned his commission.
If we connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah,
these early painful experiences, especially the frustrations with the British command structure and the petty rivalries among colonial forces, were absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
They didn't just teach him about military tactics. They instilled in him a deep, visceral understanding of what a unified, effective American military and a strong central government would need to look like. He saw firsthand the dangers of disunity and hierarchical arrogance.
Yeah, so this raises an important question for us to ponder.
Yeah.
How much of his later statesmanship, his unwavering commitment to national unity, was truly forged in the fires of these early, sometimes humiliating, conflicts?
It's a key question. I think a tremendous amount. These weren't just bumps in the road, they were foundational.
An excellent, crucial point. He wasn't out of uniform for long, though. The memory of those slights must have lingered. In 1755, he volunteered as an aide to the ill-fated General Edward Braddock,
Braddock's expedition. Another learning experience.
Right, leading a large British expedition to expel the French from Fort Duquesne. Washington, ever pragmatic, even recommended splitting the army into a main and flying column for greater agility, though his advice wasn't fully heeded.
Which proved to be a mistake.
Yeah. And he was suffering from severe dysentery at the time, a truly debilitating illness, but he rejoined Braddock at Monongahela just in time for an ambush that became a catastrophic defeat.
Indeed. It was a brutal day. The French and their Indian allies ambushed the divided British army with devastating effectiveness. Two-thirds of the British force became casualties and Braddock himself was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Despite his incapacitating illness, Washington, showing immense personal courage, rallied the terrified survivors and formed a rear guard, allowing for a somewhat orderly retreat. His bravery was undeniable.
Incredible stories from that day.
Absolutely. He had two horses shot out from under him. His hat and coat were pierced by multiple bullets, yet somehow he remained unharmed. His conduct under fire really redeemed his reputation from the Fort Necessity debacle, proved his courage and leadership in crisis.
But even after this heroic effort,
still wasn't enough for the Brits.
He was still largely excluded from planning by the succeeding British commander, maintaining that bitter taste of...
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Colonial inferiority.
So even after proving himself under the most intense pressure, he continued to butt up against the limitations placed on colonial officers. He was reappointed commander of the Virginia Regiment, rank of colonel, by Dinwiddie in August 1755.
Okay, back in charge of the Virginians.
But the friction persisted. He continued to clash over seniority, this time with Captain John Dagworthy of a Maryland detachment. He grew increasingly impatient for a decisive offensive against Fort Duquesne, seeing the strategic necessity.
Right, he wanted action.
He did. And he repeatedly pressed for a royal commission from successive British commanders-in-chief William Shirley, then Lord Loudoun, but was consistently refused and, you could argue, humiliated. This sustained condescension truly fostered a deep-seated hostility towards the British imperial system in him. It wasn't just a personal slight, it was systemic.
And that systemic issue, that was a clear turning point in his perspective, wasn't it? Shifting his loyalties and his understanding of power.
Definitely. By 1758, the Virginia Regiment was assigned to the British Forbes Expedition, another attempt to capture Fort Duquesne. General John Forbes, while accepting some of Washington's strategic advice, ultimately rejected his preferred route through the wilderness.
Still not fully trusted.
Exactly. Washington was made a brevet brigadier general, an honorary rank, mind you, that didn't come with the full pay or command authority of a regular brigadier.
Ah, symbolic gesture.
Pretty much, yeah. And given command of one of three brigades for the assault. However, in a rather anticlimactic twist, the French abandoned and burned the fort before the attack even materialized.
So no big battle.
No. Washington's main combat experience during this expedition was tragically witnessing a friendly fire incident resulting in 14 dead and 26 injured.
Oh, awful.
Yeah. Frustrated by the lack of decisive action and the ongoing indignities, he resigned his commission soon afterwards and returned to Mount Vernon, profoundly disillusioned with the colonial military structure and his place within it.
Looking back at this entire colonial military period, it's clear he gained an incredible, if brutal, education. He defended 300 miles of frontier against 20 Indian attacks in just 10 months. That's a testament to his tactical vigilance.
Absolutely.
He significantly increased the professionalism of the Virginia Regiment, growing it from 300 to 1,000 men, essentially building a standing army from scratch in a very short time.
He learned logistics, training, discipline.
Right. He gained immense self-confidence, honed his leadership skills, and acquired invaluable knowledge of British military tactics and, crucially, their weaknesses. But perhaps most significantly, that destructive competition he witnessed among colonial politicians and the systemic arrogance of British command directly fostered his later unwavering support for a strong, unified central government. He saw the rope of sand long before he used the phrase.
That last point is absolutely vital. His failures and frustrations under British command, coupled with the disunity and petty rivalries among colonial forces, were not just setbacks. They were powerful foundational lessons. They showed him firsthand the absolute imperative of a unified command and a strong national identity for effective independent action. He understood from direct experience that without a coherent national authority, any grand endeavor, military or otherwise, was doomed to flounder.
That understanding, born from humiliation and hardship, would profoundly shape his vision for the future of the American experiment. Hashtag tag marriage, civilian and political life, 1759 to 1775.
So after these tumultuous military years, Washington was ready to settle down, or at least that was the idea. On January 6, 1759, a 26-year-old George Washington married Martha Dandridge Custis.
Martha, a key figure.
A very key figure. She's a 27-year-old wealthy widow, described as intelligent, gracious, and remarkably experienced in managing a planter's estate, no small feat in colonial Virginia.
Right, she knew her stuff.
She did. And by all accounts, despite being a marriage that certainly had practical benefits, they had a genuinely happy and affectionate marriage.
That's good to hear.
But this union, it wasn't just about personal happiness. It significantly increased his wealth and social standing. It gave him control over Martha's one-third dower interest, her widow's inherited share of her previous husband's estate, in the expansive 18,000-acre Custis estate.
Wow, 18,000 acres.
Huge. And he also managed the remaining two-thirds for her young children, John Park Custis, known as Jackie, and Martha Park Custis, or Patsy.
So this was a pivotal moment for both his economic and social trajectory.
Absolutely. With his new financial leverage and his own astute land acquisitions, he aggressively expanded Mount Vernon, doubling it to 6,500 acres. By 1775, he had more than doubled its slave population to over 100, reflecting the scale of his agricultural operations.
Mm-hmm.
He also actively pursued further land acquisition, inspecting lands in the Ohio and Great Kanawha regions, and eventually purchased over 20,000 acres from veterans, though some later felt they had been, well, duped by the deals.
Controversial even then.
It cemented his position as one of Virginia's wealthiest and most influential planters.
But despite this impressive facade of wealth, Washington faced significant personal financial struggles. That's a surprising nugget, isn't it? It actually mirrored the broader economic vulnerabilities of the colonies.
It really did. His profligate spending on luxury goods imported from England, combined with persistently low tobacco prices, left him 1,800 pounds in debt by 1764.
That was a substantial sum back then. Real anxiety.
Oh, yeah. And his heavy reliance on his London tobacco buyer, Robert Carey, also meant his economic security was perpetually tied to the whims of British markets and agents. Created a deep sense of vulnerability, I think.
You can see how that would fuel resentment later on.
Precisely. This personal financial pressure and the economic indignity of being indebted to British merchants forced him to innovate. Between 1764 and 1766, he made a strategic decision to diversify Mount Vernon's primary cash crop.
Smart. Get away from just tobacco.
Exactly. Shifting from the volatile tobacco market to the more stable cultivation of wheat. He also expanded into flour milling and hemp farming, transforming Mount Vernon into a more diversified and self-sufficient and hopefully profitable estate.
Right.
And in a sad but financially impactful turn of events, Patsy's death in 1773, after years of suffering from epileptic attacks, allowed Washington to use part of her inheritance to finally settle his significant debts.
Wow. That blend of personal tragedy and financial relief. It's a poignant detail. Underscores the complex realities of life and death in the 18th century.
It really does.
So we see a George Washington who wasn't just a soldier. He was a shrewd businessman, a political novice who became a vocal critic of the crown, and a man deeply invested in the economic future of his region. It sounds like his personal finances and burgeoning political philosophy were intertwined in fascinating and deeply personal ways.
They absolutely were. As a respected military hero, albeit one with a complex record and a large landowner, he held local offices and was elected to the Virginia House of Burgesses in 1758, serving for 7 years.
And it's worth noting he'd actually been defeated in earlier campaigns for the seat in 55 and 57. Shows that even future icons face political hurdles.
Right. Not always a smooth path. And this period is absolutely critical for understanding his evolution. Initially, he was no firebrand orator. He rarely spoke or even attended legislative sessions.
And kept his head down at first.
Yeah. But he became much more politically active in the 1760s, gradually emerging as a prominent and increasingly vocal critic of Britain's taxation and mercantilist policies. He was vehemently opposed to the British Parliament's taxes without proper representation, a principle he saw as fundamentally unjust.
The core issue.
The core issue. He believed the Stamp Act of 1765 was oppressive and famously celebrated its repeal. That marks an early alignment with burgeoning revolutionary sentiment.
And he wasn't just complaining. He was organizing, mobilizing. In May 1769, in direct response to the Townshend Acts, he introduced a proposal urging Virginians to boycott British goods.
A direct economic protest. Very effective.
Yeah, and it worked, as most of the acts were repealed in 1770. He was also deeply angered by the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which, after the French and Indian War, banned American settlement west of the Allegheny Mountains.
Right, hitting him right where he lived, Western land speculation.
Exactly. This directly interfered with American Western land speculation, a venture he was personally and heavily invested in. He viewed the coercive acts of 1774, passed to punish Massachusetts for the Boston Tea Party, not just as an affront to Bostonians, but as an invasion of our rights and privileges across all the colonies. It became clear that his personal interests were aligning with a broader colonial grievance.
His personal and financial interests, coupled with a deep sense of justice and his military experience with British overreach, undoubtedly fueled his political awakening. He wasn't just observing, he was actively stepping towards revolution. In July 1774, he and George Mason drafted a powerful set of resolutions for the Fairfax County Committee.
Mm-hmm.
These included a significant and early call to end the Atlantic slave trade, a remarkable stance for a major slaveholder at the time, which were subsequently adopted.
That is remarkable.
Yeah. The following month, he attended the first Virginia Convention and was selected as a delegate to the First Continental Congress. As tensions escalated throughout 1774, he actively helped train militias in Virginia and organized the enforcement of the Continental Association, that widespread boycott of British goods. He was preparing for what was clearly and rapidly coming next, armed conflict. Hashtag tag, 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 Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, 1775 to 1783.
And what came next was nothing less than a full-blown revolution. The American Revolutionary War broke out April 19, 1775. Lexington and Concord set the colonies ablaze.
The point of no return.
Washington, without hesitation, hastily departed Mount Vernon on May 4th to join the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia. On June 14th, Congress, recognizing the urgent need for a unified military, created the Continental Army.
A huge step.
And John Adams, seeing his military experience and, crucially, the political advantage of uniting the colonies behind a Virginian, nominated Washington as its commander-in-chief.
It was a truly momentous decision, unanimously affirmed by Congress the very next day. Ron Chernow noted his superior presence, infinitely better judgment, more political cunning, and unmatched gravitas.
Oh, praise.
Indeed. Washington accepted the commission on June 16th, delivering an acceptance speech where he notably declined a salary, asking only to be reimbursed for his expenses.
A powerful statement right from the start. Very symbolic.
Absolutely. It immediately cemented his image as a man above personal gain, serving for the cause alone.
A crucial signal for a fledgling nation. Congress then chose his primary staff officers, a mix of experienced and emerging talents. Artemus Ward, Horatio Gates, Charles Lee, Philip Schuyler, Nathaniel Greene.
A real collection of figures there.
Yeah. Henry Knox, a former bookseller with an impressive knowledge of ordnance, was quickly promoted to Colonel-in-Chief of Artillery.
Knox was brilliant.
And a young Alexander Hamilton, whose intelligence and bravery impressed Washington, was rapidly promoted to Colonel and appointed as an aide-de-camp. That began one of history's most consequential mentor-protege relationships.
The Hamilton connection. So important. He truly surrounded himself with diverse talent, learning quickly who he could trust.
He certainly did, but, you know, it's important to acknowledge the complexities and the moral contradictions of the era, right? Washington's initial policy on black soldiers is a stark reminder of these historical realities.
Absolutely. Can't ignore that.
He initially banned the enlistment of black soldiers, both free and enslaved, reflected prevalent prejudices and, frankly, fears of arming enslaved people.
But the British, ever opportunistic, saw this as a strategic opening. Virginia's colonial governor, Lord Dunmore, issued a proclamation offering freedom to enslaved people who joined British forces.
Putting pressure on Washington.
Huge pressure. In response to this existential threat and the urgent, undeniable need for troops, Washington swiftly and pragmatically overturned his ban.
Unnecessary reversal.
Completely necessary. By the end of the war, approximately one-tenth of Continental Army soldiers were black, with many obtaining their freedom as a direct result of their service. This policy shift, born of necessity, had a profound and often overlooked impact on individual lives and the nascent fight for freedom.
Let's talk campaigns, because these were really the crucible of his leadership. April 1775, before Washington even arrived, British troops under General Thomas Gage occupied Boston. Local militias had surrounded the city, creating this tense standoff.
Mm-hmm. The Siege of Boston begins.
As Washington traveled north to assume command, he was greeted by cheering crowds. He was already becoming this powerful, almost mythical symbol of the Patriot cause. But upon his arrival on July 2nd, he found not a disciplined army, but an enthusiastic yet chaotic militia.
Right. Lots of spirit. Not much structure.
Exactly. He immediately initiated reforms, influenced by Benjamin Franklin's suggestions, instituting military drills, strict discipline, promoting deserving soldiers, and crucially, removing incompetent officers. He brought order to potential chaos. In October, King George III declared the colonies in open rebellion and replaced Gage with General William Howe.
Washington proved incredibly adept at bringing order and discipline to a raw, untrained force. The Siege of Boston became his first major test. When the Charles River froze, Washington, ever the aggressive commander, wanted to storm Boston.
Bold move.
Very bold. But his generals, more cautious, advised against it. Instead, he agreed to a more strategic maneuver, securing the Dorchester Heights overlooking Boston.
Ah, the high ground.
Classic, classic. This positioned his newly disciplined artillery, brought all the way by Henry Knox from Fort Ticonderoga, to bombard the British. On March 17, 1776, faced with an untenable position, 8,906 British troops, 1,100 loyalists, and 12,220 women and children began a chaotic naval evacuation.
Huge victory. Boston liberated.
Massive victory. Washington, entering Boston with 500 men, gave explicit orders not to plunder and deliberately left civilian matters to local authorities. Mm-hmm. This showed a strategic mind prioritizing not just military victory, but...
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Also, civilian order and setting a precedent for humane conduct, even in war.
After the victory in Boston, Washington correctly anticipated that the British, with their superior navy, would turn their attention to New York City, a vital port, a strategic hub.
The logical next target.
He arrived there on April 13, 1776, immediately ordering extensive fortifications and, again, insisting his forces treat civilians and their property with respect. He understood that the hearts and minds of the populace were as important as territory.
Absolutely. Public support was key.
By July, massive British forces, over 100 ships, tens of thousands of troops began arriving on Staten Island to lay siege. General Howe's strength was immense. 32,000 regulars and Hessian auxiliaries against Washington's meager 23,000, most of whom were untrained recruits and short-term militia. The odds were, well, terrifying.
The ensuing New York and New Jersey campaign was a near disaster. It pushed Washington to his absolute limits. In August, Howe landed 20,000 troops at Gravesend, Brooklyn. Washington tragically overruling some of his generals based on inaccurate intelligence about Howe's true numbers.
A critical mistake.
Chose to fight the Battle of Long Island. Howe, a far more experienced commander, skillfully outmaneuvered him, inflicting a staggering 1,500 Patriot casualties. Washington was forced into this desperate, daring nighttime retreat across the East River to Manhattan, barely saving his army.
The fog saved them.
The fog helped immensely. Howe even attempted peace negotiations, addressing Washington dismissively as George Washington Esquire.
Ouch. A deliberate slight?
Oh, yeah. A slight, Washington refused, demanding diplomatic protocol as a recognized general, not a rebel. He eventually retreated across the Hudson to Fort Lee, and Howe captured Fort Washington in November, inflicting another heavy blow. Loyalists, seizing the moment, spread rumors that Washington had even set fire to New York City.
Propaganda war heating up.
Definitely. His army was now reduced to just 5,400 exhausted, disheartened troops retreating through New Jersey. It was, without question, the lowest point of the war for the Continental Army.
The situation looked dire, truly apocalyptic for the American cause. The future of the Continental Army was deeply in doubt due to a critical lack of supplies, the onset of a brutal winter, rapidly expiring enlistments, and widespread desertions. Hope was fading fast.
It really seemed like the end was near.
Washington made a desperate but brilliant move, crossing the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, where he was reinforced by General John Sullivan with 2,000 more troops. The British, overconfident after their string of victories, had posted a Hessian garrison at Trenton to hold western New Jersey for the winter, a move they would come to regret.
This set the stage for one of the war's most iconic and strategically brilliant moments, a true masterclass in turning the tide. At sunrise on December 26, 1776, Washington, against all odds, led a successful surprise attack on the Hessians at Trenton after that perilous Christmas night crossing of the Delaware.
The famous crossing.
Aided by Colonel Henry Knox and his artillery, they achieved a stunning victory. This audacious success was immediately followed by another equally brilliant attack on British regulars at Princeton on January 3, 1777.
Back-to-back wins.
Back-to-back. The Americans inflicted 273 British casualties against only 40 American. These two victories dramatically changed the course of the war, shattering British overconfidence and breathing new life into the Patriot cause.
Huge morale boost.
Immense. Howe, completely surprised, retreated to New York City for the winter, and Washington established winter headquarters at Morristown, New Jersey. These victories were pivotal, not just militarily, but psychologically. Revived Patriot morale and quashed the British strategy of a swift, decisive campaign. It was a stark demonstration of Washington's capacity for strategic improvisation and leadership under extreme pressure.
What's fascinating here is the sheer resilience. Washington faced constant challenges. Untrained troops, lack of supplies, internal criticism, even outright treason later on. Yet he adapted, he learned, and he ultimately led them to victory. Let's not forget the Philadelphia campaign of 1777, another brutal test.
Right. The British general John Burgoyne was leading his Saratoga campaign south from Quebec, aiming to divide New England. Crucially, General Howe, with a perplexing decision.
Still debated today, right, why he did that.
Absolutely. Instead of linking up with Burgoyne, he took his main army from New York City south to Philadelphia. This split in British strategy would have massive consequences.
It truly did. While Howe captured the American capital, Philadelphia, it came at a significant cost to the broader British strategy. Washington and Lafayette rushed to Philadelphia to engage Howe. In the Battle of Brandywine on September 11, Howe once again outmaneuvered Washington, and the British marched unopposed into Philadelphia.
Another defeat for Washington personally.
Yeah. A Patriot counterattack at Germantown in October also failed. Meanwhile, far to the north in upstate New York, Patriots led by General Horatio Gates, crucially reinforced by Generals Benedict Arnold and Benjamin Lincoln sent from Washington, forced Burgoyne to surrender his entire army at Saratoga on October 7, 1777.
Saratoga, the turning point of the war.
Absolutely. Gates's victory was monumental, securing essential French support. But it also, unfortunately, emboldened Washington's critics, who increasingly favored Gates as a military leader. Whispers started, and admiration for Washington was waning in some circles, even as he faced constant defeats.
A tough pill to swallow after his own setbacks, with a major victory happening elsewhere under another commander.
Yeah.
December 1777 saw Washington's army of 11,000 men go into brutal winter quarters at Valley Forge, north of Philadelphia.
Valley Forge. The name itself evokes hardship.
It was a period of immense suffering. They lost between 2,000 and 3,000 men to disease, starvation, lack of clothing, and inadequate shelter, reducing the army to below 9,000. By February, morale was desperately low and desertions increased. An internal revolt by disgruntled officers, famously known as the Conway Cabal, even prompted some members of Congress to consider removing Washington from command.
Seriously, they considered replacing him.
They did. The pressure was immense. His loyal supporters, however, resisted, and the matter was eventually dropped. But the challenge to his leadership was very real.
This period really highlights the depth of the crisis and Washington's unparalleled ability to hold things together through sheer force of will.
Absolutely. He repeatedly and passionately petitioned Congress for provisions, stressing the dire urgency of the situation. Congress, finally recognizing the gravity, responded by strengthening supply lines and reorganizing departments. Washington, ever resourceful, launched the Grand Forage of 1778 to collect food from the surrounding countryside.
Whatever it took.
Whatever it took. And crucially, it was at Valley Forge that Baron Friedrich Wilhelm von Steuben, a Prussian military officer, implemented rigorous drilling that transformed these raw recruits into a disciplined, professional fighting force.
Von Steuben, his training made a huge difference.
Massive difference. Washington, recognizing his genius, appointed him Inspector General.
And just as things looked their bleakest, a major turning point arrived in early 1778. France officially entered into a treaty of alliance with the Americans.
Game changer.
Totally. Bringing vital naval power, troops, and financial aid. This shifted the strategic calculus entirely. In May, General Howe, facing a strengthened American force and new French involvement, resigned and was replaced by Sir Henry Clinton.
The British evacuated Philadelphia for New York in June, and Washington ordered a limited strike on their retreating forces. Generals Lee and Lafayette, however, kind of bungled their first strike on June 28th.
Right, Washington famously relieved Lee of command right there on the battlefield.
He did. Despite this, he managed to achieve a tactical draw after an expansive battle at Monmouth. The British continued their retreat to New York. This battle marked the end of the war's campaigning in the northern and middle states for Washington for over 3 years, as British attention dramatically shifted to the southern theater.
Meanwhile, Washington ordered a punitive expedition against the Iroquois, destroying many of their villages, responding to their alliance with the British. A harsh, controversial move.
A very harsh move, reflecting the brutality of frontier warfare. If we zoom out a bit, Washington's ability to keep a poorly equipped, often starving army together through sheer force of will and strategic improvisation, even through failures like Long Island and the suffering of Valley Forge, was arguably his greatest military achievement.
Keeping the army in the field, that was the key.
Exactly. This raises an important question. How did these experiences, witnessing the fragility of an army and the disunity of states, specifically shape his deep-seated belief in a strong central government, especially given the institutional weaknesses he saw firsthand? It was here, in the crucible of war, that his understanding of national power was truly forged.
And speaking of strategy, his role as America's first spymaster is also fascinating. He designed an incredibly effective espionage system against the British.
Absolutely. It's a lesser-known but critical aspect of his genius. In 1778, Major Benjamin Tallmadge, a trusted officer, formed the Culper Ring under Washington's direct instruction.
The Culper Ring sounds like a spy novel.
It really does. This covert network of spies gathered vital intelligence about the British in New York. This intelligence, in one instance, actually saved French forces from a surprise British attack. An attack, ironically, based on intelligence, from Washington's own general-turned-British spy, Benedict Arnold.
Wow. The layers of intrigue are astounding. Arnold's treason. It remains one of the most infamous betrayals in American history.
And it speaks volumes about Washington's character that he had previously disregarded incidents of disloyalty by Arnold, who had, until then, distinguished himself in many campaigns.
Gave him the benefit of the doubt, maybe too much.
Perhaps. But in 1779, Arnold began supplying British spymaster John André with sensitive information intended to allow the British to capture West Point, a key American defensive position on the Hudson River. On September 21st, Arnold gave André detailed plans to take over the garrison.
Unbelievable betrayal.
However, André was captured, the plans discovered, and Arnold, tipped off, barely escaped to New York, joining the British. Washington, upon learning of this profound treason, acted with incredible swiftness and decisiveness.
What did he do?
He immediately recalled commanders serving under Arnold, assumed personal command at West Point, and reorganized its defenses. This rapid, decisive action in the face of such a profound betrayal underscores his unwavering leadership and his absolute focus on the security of the nation. No hesitation.
Moving to the Southern Theater, by June 1780, the British had firmly occupied the South Carolina Piedmont and had established firm control of the Southern colonies. It looked grim for the Americans down there.
Very grim. Cornwallis seemed unstoppable.
But Washington was reinvigorated by the return of his beloved Marquis de Lafayette from France, bringing promises of more ships, men, and crucial supplies.
Lafayette's return was a huge morale boost.
Then, 5,000 veteran French troops led by Marshal Rochambeau arrived in Rhode Island in July, a truly welcome sight. Even Benedict Arnold, now a British brigadier general, was sent to Virginia in December with 1,700 troops to capture Portsmouth and raid Patriot forces, with Washington sending Lafayette to counter him. The stakes were incredibly high.
Washington initially hoped to fight a decisive battle in New York, aiming to draw British forces away from Virginia. But Rochambeau, possessing a keen strategic mind and experience with siege warfare.
More experience than Washington in that area.
Definitely. He advised him that Lord Cornwallis in Virginia was the better, more vulnerable target for a combined French-American force. On August 19, 1781, Washington and Rochambeau began what became known as the Celebrated March to Yorktown, Virginia.
The March South.
A deception so effective that the British didn't realize their true target until it was too late. Washington commanded an impressive combined army, 7,800 Frenchmen, 3,100 militia, and 8,000 Continental troops.
What's truly remarkable here is that despite Washington's limited experience in siege warfare and his frequent deference to Rochambeau's judgment on tactical details, his authority as the overall commanding officer was never challenged.
Speaks volumes about the respect he commanded.
Yeah, and his ability to work effectively in a coalition. By late September, Patriot French forces had completely surrounded Yorktown, trapping the British army. Crucially, the French Navy, under Admiral de Grasse, was victorious at the Battle of the Chesapeake.
Cutting off the escape route. Absolutely vital.
Completing the encirclement and cutting off any hope of British escape or reinforcement by sea. Washington himself fired the first shot of the final American offensive, a symbolically powerful act.
The siege ended with a British surrender on October 19, 1781. Over 7,000 British soldiers became prisoners of war. Washington, maintaining his dignified bearing, personally negotiated the terms of surrender over 2 days.
Yorktown, the decisive battle.
It really was. Although the official peace treaty wasn't signed for 2 more years, Yorktown proved to be the last significant battle of the Revolutionary War. The British Parliament, demoralized by the defeat, finally agreed to cease hostilities in March 1782. It was a decisive, stunning end to a long, arduous conflict and a testament to the power of perseverance and international alliance.
But the work wasn't over, even with the fighting winding down. When peace negotiations began in April 1782, both the British and French gradually evacuated their forces from America. In March 1783, Washington faced a final critical test of his leadership. He successfully calmed the Newburgh conspiracy.
The potential mutiny. Very dangerous moment.
Yeah, a planned mutiny by American officers over a lack of pay and pensions who felt betrayed by Congress. His powerful emotional address revealing his own failing eyesight brought many officers to tears and averted a potential military coup, ensuring civilian control of the military.
A masterful display of leadership, saving the Republic from itself, almost.
He then submitted an account of $450,000 in expenses he had personally advanced to the Army throughout the war. The account, while vague about some large sums and including his wife's expenses incurred during her visits to his headquarters, was ultimately settled, reflects the trust placed in him.
The Treaty of Paris, signed on September 3, 1783, officially recognized American independence. With the war over and independence secured, Washington began the process of demobilizing his army, giving an emotional farewell address to his soldiers on November 2nd. He then oversaw the evacuation of British forces in New York and was greeted by parades and celebrations.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Truly a national hero returning home.
In early December 1783, Washington bade a poignant farewell to his officers at France's Tavern in New York City. Then, in a final appearance in uniform, he traveled to Annapolis, Maryland to resign his commission as Commander-in-Chief before Congress.
A truly historic moment.
He famously declared, "I consider it an indispensable duty to close this last solemn act of my official life by commending the interests of our dearest country to the protection of Almighty God." This act of voluntarily relinquishing power was globally acclaimed, set a profound precedent for civilian control of the military and the peaceful transfer of power.
Almost unheard of in the 18th century. Victorious generals usually seized power. King George III himself reportedly remarked, "If he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world."
Amazing. He was also appointed President General of the Society of the Cincinnati, that new hereditary fraternity of Revolutionary War officers, cementing his ongoing influence.
His resignation was arguably one of his most important acts of statesmanship, even before he held political office. It wasn't just a personal choice, it was a profound institutional statement. This raises that important question again. How did these experiences witnessing firsthand the fragility of an army, the disunity of states, the challenges of maintaining Republican ideals shape his deep-seated belief in a strong central government, especially given the institutional weaknesses he saw firsthand?
It seems unavoidable. The war itself was the best argument for a stronger Union.
Exactly. It was here, in the crucible of war and its aftermath, that his understanding of national power and the need for a unified Union was truly irrevocably forged. Hashtag, tag, tag, Early Republican Constitutional Convention, 1783 to 1789.
So after 8.5 grueling years of war, with only 10 days spent at his beloved Mount Vernon, Washington was, understandably, eager to return home. Arrived on Christmas Eve, Professor John E. Furling wrote that he was delighted to be free in the bustle of camp and the busy scenes of public life.
Ready for retirement, or so he thought.
Yeah. He envisioned a peaceful retirement, but as a national icon, that proved to be something of an illusion. He received a constant stream of visitors and well-wishers paying their respects, which, while flattering, must have been far less restful than he'd hoped.
Indeed, private life was perhaps a relative term for a man of his stature. Despite his desire for quiet, he immediately reactivated his pre-war business interests, including investments in the Great Dismal Swamp and the Potomac Canal projects.
Ambitious infrastructure ventures for the time.
Very. Though neither paid him any significant dividends in the immediate post-war period. He was still a businessman, though, and even undertook a strenuous 34-day, 680-mile trip in 1784 to personally check on his extensive landholdings in the Ohio country.
Wow, that's a long trip on horseback.
It sure was.
Yeah.
At Mount Vernon, he oversaw extensive remodeling work, transforming it into the grand mansion we largely see today, a clear statement of his continuing ambition and status.
But despite the outward appearance of grandeur, his financial situation was, surprisingly, not strong at all, particularly in the immediate aftermath of the war.
Right. That's a recurring theme.
Creditors often paid him in depreciated wartime currency, which was nearly worthless, and he, in turn, owed significant amounts in taxes and wages to his workers and suppliers. Mount Vernon had made virtually no profit during his long absence, and he faced persistently poor crop yields due to pestilence and bad weather. Recorded its 11th consecutive year at a deficit in 1787.
11 years in the red. That's serious. This personal financial instability, it deeply influenced his view of the new nation's own economic challenges and the fragility of a weak currency under the Articles.
You can see the direct connection. This financial pressure was a personal mirror of the national crisis.
Absolutely. To make the estate profitable again, he undertook new landscaping projects, cultivated fast-growing trees and native shrubs, and in a remarkably forward-thinking move, began breeding mules.
Mules, really?
Yeah, after being gifted a stud by King Charles III of Spain in 1785. He truly believed these robust hybrids would revolutionize agriculture by providing stronger, more resilient labor than horses or oxen.
Shows that innovative streak again, constantly seeking practical solutions, whether on his farm or for the nation.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is his initial reluctance, even despair, during the Constitutional Convention later on, which speaks volumes about the immense challenges of forging a union from such disparate states. But before fully settling back into private life in June 1783, Washington had already voiced a powerful call for a strong union.
Even before the Constitution was really on the table.
Right. Despite his concerns about military figures meddling in civil matters, he sent a crucial circular letter to the states arguing that the Articles of Confederation were, quote, more than a rope of sand. A stark warning that he felt compelled to issue.
A rope of sand. Powerful image.
It is. He genuinely believed the nascent nation was on the verge of anarchy and confusion and dangerously vulnerable to foreign intervention, echoing his frustrations from the colonial military era. He passionately advocated for a national constitution to unify the states under a strong, effective central government. Events like Shazer's Rebellion in Massachusetts in August 1786.
Right, the farmers' uprising.
That armed uprising by farmers against debt collection and taxes further convinced him of this urgent need. This widespread unrest spurred nationalists to meet in Annapolis on September 11, 1786, to ask Congress to revise the Articles of Confederation, setting the stage for a dramatic constitutional overhaul.
Congress, spurred by the growing crisis, agreed to a constitutional convention in Philadelphia in 1787, with each state sending delegates. Washington, almost by acclamation, was chosen to lead the Virginia delegation. However, he initially declined.
He was reluctant again.
Yeah, expressing concerns about the convention's legality and his own desire for retirement. But James Madison, Henry Knox, and other influential figures saw his presence as indispensable. They persuaded him to attend, believing his gravitas alone would induce reluctant states to send delegates, smooth the arduous process of ratification, and lend immense, undeniable legitimacy to the entire convention. His presence was seen as the linchpin for success.
And their persuasion worked. He arrived in Philadelphia on May 9, 1787, and when the convention officially began on May 25, Benjamin Franklin, the elder statesman, nominated Washington to preside over the meeting. He was unanimously elected, a testament to his universal respect.
So he's presiding over this crucial, contentious meeting.
Right. During the proceedings, Edmund Randolph introduced James Madison's Virginia Plan, calling for an entirely new constitution and a sovereign national government, a plan which Washington highly recommended. However, the details around representation, particularly between large and small states, proved incredibly contentious, leading to a competing New Jersey plan.
The big state-small state fight.
Exactly. The debates were, by all accounts, incredibly intense, pushing Washington to the brink of frustration. On July 10th, he wrote to Alexander Hamilton, expressing his genuine despair. I almost despair of seeing a favorable issue to the proceedings of our convention and do therefore repent having had any agency in the business.
Wow. That's a striking admission of doubt from such a resolute figure.
It really is. Nevertheless, he steadfastly lent his immense prestige to the work of the other delegates, actively lobbying many behind the scenes to support the Constitution's eventual ratification. The final version, a result of the Great Compromise, or Connecticut Compromise, between the two plans, was signed by 39 of the 55 delegates on September 17, 1787, a monumental achievement against incredible odds.
This period truly underscores his understanding that military victory alone wasn't enough. The nation needed a robust, enduring foundation to survive and thrive.
Absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, his initial reluctance and even despair during the Constitutional Convention were not weaknesses, but rather highlighted the immense, almost insurmountable challenges of forging a lasting union from disparate states with competing interests. His unwavering commitment to lending his immense gravitas to this messy, difficult political process, even when he personally doubted its outcome, was indispensable. It demonstrates how a leader's willingness to engage in complex political negotiations despite personal cost and frustration can be as crucial as military genius.
Just prior to the first presidential election of 1789, Washington was appointed Chancellor of the College of William and Mary in 1788, serving until his death. Another sign of his continued public service.
Mm-hmm. The delegates, it's clear, anticipated his presidency. They specifically left the role of president loosely defined, essentially leaving it to him to define the office once elected, placing an enormous burden on his shoulders.
Yeah, figure it out as you go.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And on February 4, 1789, in a truly unprecedented and unique achievement, Washington was unanimously elected the first U.S. president by the Electoral College.
Unanimous. Amazing.
Still the only one. John Adams was elected vice president. Despite feeling anxious and painful sensations about leaving the quiet life of Mount Vernon, the call to duty was undeniable. Washington departed for New York City on April 16th, ready to embark on perhaps his most challenging role yet. # presidency, 1789-1797.
This period truly showcases the immense burden placed on Washington. To define a new office while holding a fragile nation together, he wasn't just a president. He was essentially a foundational architect, building the very structure of American governance as he went.
Absolutely. He was setting the mold.
So what does this all mean for us? He was literally building the presidency from scratch while simultaneously navigating a world on fire, fighting internal rebellion, and fending off foreign entanglements. It's truly incredible how many precedents he set, many of which we take for granted today.
Mm-hmm.
His inauguration took place on April 30th, 1789, at Federal Hall in New York City. It was a grand affair. His coach was led by militia and a marching band, followed by statesmen and foreign dignitaries, with a crowd of 10,000 lining the streets.
Quite the scene.
Robert R. Livingston administered the oath, famously using a Bible provided by the Masons. Washington then read a deeply resonant speech, asking that Almighty Being consecrate the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States.
The careful thought he put into even the smallest details, like what to be called, speaks volumes about his long-term vision and understanding of institutional weight. Though he wished to serve without a salary, Congress rightly insisted, providing $25,000 annually. He believed that, as the first of everything in our situation will serve to establish a precedent, it is devoutly wished on my part that these precedents be fixed on true principles.
That's the key phrase, true principles.
That guiding philosophy shaped his every action. He famously argued against majestic monarchical titles like His Majesty or His Highness the President, firmly favoring the simple yet dignified Mr. President.
A very Republican choice.
Very. His executive precedents included the inaugural address, regular messages to Congress, and perhaps most importantly, the cabinet form of the executive branch. He also selected the first justices for the Supreme Court, ensuring the judicial branch was functional from day one.
He truly was laying the groundwork, brick by brick. Washington proved to be an incredibly able administrator and a remarkably keen judge of talent and character. Recognizing the inherent weaknesses of the old Confederation, Congress, guided by his vision, quickly created executive departments in 1789.
Getting the government machinery running.
Right. He appointed an impressive, if eventually contentious, cabinet. Edmund Randolph as Attorney General, Samuel Osgood as Postmaster General, Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State, Henry Knox as Secretary of War, and the brilliant, if polarizing, Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of the Treasury.
Quite a lineup of talent. And yeah. Strong personalities.
Definitely. This cabinet became a crucial consulting and advisory body, though it wasn't constitutionally mandated. Washington, drawing on his military command style, restricted discussions to his chosen topics and expected his department heads to agreeably carry out his decisions, emphasizing unity in action.
He wanted cohesion. He also exercised remarkable restraint in using his veto power, famously noting, "I give my signature to many bills with which my judgment is at variance."
Interesting. So he signed things he didn't fully agree with.
Yeah, indicating a respect for the legislative process, even when he privately disagreed. This restraint became another vital precedent, curbing executive overreach.
Washington himself vehemently opposed political factionalism and remained staunchly nonpartisan throughout his entire presidency, a unique distinction among all U.S. presidents.
The only one.
Though his sympathies clearly lay with a federalist form of government, he genuinely strove for national unity. However, this ideal quickly fractured. His closest advisors, despite his wishes, soon formed two distinct factions.
The beginnings of parties.
Exactly. Hamilton, pushing for national credit in a financially powerful nation, formed the Federalist Party. Thomas Jefferson, on the other hand, founded the Jeffersonian Republicans, adamantly opposing Hamilton's ambitious financial agenda, particularly the National Bank.
The Hamilton-Jefferson feud defined the era.
It really did. Washington, though, largely favored Hamilton's agenda, which ultimately went into effect, leading to bitter and deeply personal controversy within his own administration. Beyond this, his first term also saw the planning of a permanent capital city, eventually named Washington, D.C., the passage of several constitutional amendments, including the Bill of Rights and ongoing debates concerning slavery and expansion into Native American territory. He even proclaimed November 26, 1789, as a national day of thanksgiving to encourage national unity and gratitude.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Washington's unwavering efforts to remain nonpartisan and his later warnings in the farewell address about the dangers of political parties and foreign alliances highlight an enduring tension in American democracy that continues to this day. This internal conflict between factions, which he so deeply abhorred, would profoundly shape his challenging second term.
He initially planned to retire after his first term, completely weary of the office, in poor health, and exhausted by the constant cabinet infighting and partisan critics.
Ready to go home.
Yeah. Martha also urged him not to run, longing for the quiet of Mount Vernon, and the critically filled state of his nephew managing the estate only increased his desire for retirement. However, a chorus of voices, including Madison, Jefferson, who, remarkably, pledged to drop his attacks on him.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
That's amazing given their rivalry.
And Hamilton himself urged him to run. They argued persuasively that his absence would worsen the burgeoning political rifts and potentially tear the fragile nation apart.
So he reluctantly agreed, demonstrating again that his commitment to the stability of the nascent nation truly trumped his deeply personal desire for retirement. On February 13, 1793, he was, for the second time, unanimously reelected president by the Electoral College.
Unanimous again. Incredible.
John Adams was also reelected vice president by a vote of 77 to 50. He was sworn into office by Associate Justice William Cushing on March 4, 1793, in Congress Hall in Philadelphia. It was a quieter inauguration, but his commitment to the nation was, if anything, more profound given the personal sacrifice.
His second term was immediately plunged into a maelstrom of foreign policy challenges. After the French Revolutionary Wars broke out in Europe, threatening to draw America into the conflict.
The huge danger for the young country.
Washington, understanding the nation's fragile state, issued a crucial proclamation declaring American neutrality on April 22, 1793. He was resolved to pursue a conduct friendly and impartial toward the belligerent powers, and vitally warned Americans not to intervene, laid the foundation for a policy of non-entanglement.
A cornerstone of early U.S. foreign policy. While he recognized France's revolutionary government, he eventually had to ask for the recall of their flamboyant minister, Edmond Charles Genet.
Citizen Genet, a real troublemaker.
He was. Hostile to Washington's neutrality policy. Genet brazenly procured American ships as privateers and organized militias against British and Spanish forces, but thankfully failed to draw the U.S. into a ruinous conflict.
Domestically, he faced two major conflicts that tested the authority of the new federal government. The first was the Whiskey Rebellion.
Right, flaring up between 1791 and 1794 in western Pennsylvania. A defiant revolt against liquor taxation. A cornerstone of Hamilton's financial plan.
How did Washington handle that?
In a powerful assertion of federal power, he mobilized a militia and notably, personally, commanded an expedition against the rebels, successfully suppressing the insurgency without significant bloodshed, established the government's authority to enforce its laws.
Showed the federal government had teeth.
Exactly. The second was the Northwest Indian War, a brutal conflict between white settlers and various Native American tribes, often supported and armed by the British, who refused to abandon their western forts after the Revolutionary War. American troops ultimately defeated the Native American forces at the Battle of Fallen Timbers in 1794.
Ending the conflict but opening up more western lands for settlement. A complex and often devastating period for indigenous communities. A reminder that progress for some often meant displacement for others.
A very difficult part of the legacy. To normalize precarious trade relations with Britain, secure their long overdue removal from Western forts, and resolve lingering financial debts from the Revolution, Alexander Hamilton formulated what became known as the Jay Treaty.
Ah, the Jay Treaty. Very controversial.
Extremely. Chief Justice John Jay signed the treaty on November 19, 1794. Washington, despite being disappointed that its provisions seemed to favor Britain over France, reluctantly supported it to avoid a potentially ruinous war with the powerful British Navy. He then mobilized public opinion and, after intense debate, secured its ratification, but faced frequent public criticism and bitter political controversy, particularly from Jeffersonian Republicans who viewed it as a betrayal of France.
What were the outcomes?
Significant, actually. And for a decade, it stabilized the nation. The British finally abandoned their Great Lakes forts, border arbitration was agreed upon, pre-revolution debts were settled, and crucially, the British West Indies were open to American merchants. This secured peace and a decade of prosperous trade with Britain.
But Jefferson wasn't happy.
Not at all. He and his allies vehemently claimed it angered France and invited, rather than avoided, war, arguing it deeply tilted American foreign policy towards Britain. Relations with France did indeed rapidly deteriorate. The French Directory authorized the seizure of American ships just 2 days before Washington's term ended, leaving President John Adams with the grim prospect of war.
So a mixed bag on that one.
Definitely. On a more positive note, Pinckney's treaty in 1795 with the Spanish successfully settled the border dispute with Spanish Florida and vitally guaranteed American navigational access to the Mississippi River,
yeah,
a crucial artery for Western expansion.
His cabinet was a revolving door by this point, wasn't it? A stark reflection of the intense partisan infighting and the personal toll of his second term.
Absolutely. Jefferson, unable to stomach Hamilton's influence, resigned as Secretary of State on July 31, 1793. Hamilton himself, feeling his financial system was secure, resigned in January 1795 and was replaced by Oliver Wolcott Jr. Secretary of War Henry Knox was also forced to resign over rumors he profited from contracts for U.S. frigates, a harsh lesson in public scrutiny.
Wow. In his final months, Washington was assailed by political foes and a partisan press, accused of ambition, greed, even monarchical tendencies. He came to regard the press as a deeply disuniting force.
He really soured on the press. He also famously opposed Congress's demands to see papers related to the Jay Treaty, arguing they were not relative to any purpose under the cognizance of the House of Representatives except that of an impeachment, setting another important precedent for executive privilege.
This was a truly tumultuous end to a groundbreaking presidency. He retired at the end of his second term, profoundly dismayed by the relentless personal attacks and desiring to ensure a truly contested presidential election, a hallmark of a healthy republic.
Right. His voluntary retirement, though he didn't feel constitutionally bound by it, set a powerful and significant precedent for the two-term limit that would eventually become codified.
And the farewell address. As early as May 1792, he had instructed James Madison to begin preparing a valedictory address.
Started planning early. By May 1796, he sent the manuscript to Hamilton for an extensive rewrite, with Washington himself providing the final, meticulous edits before it was published on September 19, 1796, in David Claypool's American Daily Advertiser.
The farewell address stands as one of the most influential statements on republicanism, a timeless warning to future generations. In it, he stressed that national identity was paramount, famously saying the name of American must always exalt the just pride of patriotism.
Powerful words. He issued dire warnings against the dangers of political parties, seeing them as sources of division, and cautioned against entangling foreign alliances, advocating instead for a policy of friendship and commerce with all nations, but advising against involvement in European wars.
The famous warnings. He also stressed the importance of religion and morality, asserting that religion and morality are indispensable supports in a virtuous republic.
He closed by reflecting on his own legacy, hoping his unintentioned errors would be averted or mitigated, and that his country would view his faults with indulgence. Initial criticism from Republicans, including Madison, was fierce. Some called it an anti-French campaign document, believing Washington was pro-British.
But history sees it differently now.
Absolutely. It was later, and rightly, recognized as a foundational document of American political thought, on par with the Declaration of Independence and Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. If we connect this to the bigger picture, his efforts to remain nonpartisan and his warnings in the farewell address highlight an enduring tension in American democracy that continues to this day, that tension between unity and division, isolationism and engagement. #tag postpresidency and death, 1797 to 1799.
It's incredible to think of him back at Mount Vernon after two terms, trying to make his farms profitable, yet still ready to step up for his country when the quasi-war threatened. He officially retired to Mount Vernon in March 1797, genuinely intending to focus on his business interests and enjoy a peaceful final chapter.
But those business interests remained a challenge. His plantation operations were minimally profitable, a persistent frustration. His extensive western lands, despite their vast acreage, yielded little income, and attempts to sell them were largely unsuccessful.
Still facing financial hurdles.
Always. Ever the pragmatist and innovator, to supplement his income, he embarked on a new venture. He erected a substantial distillery for whiskey production.
Wait, the man who suppressed the whiskey rebellion started making whiskey?
He did. A surprising turn, but a practical business decision. Shows his entrepreneurial spirit, constantly adapting to try and manage his assets.
He also strategically bought land parcels to spur development around the new federal city, named in his honor in 1791. He took an unusual approach, selling individual lots to middle-income investors rather than offloading multiple lots to large investors.
Believing that smaller, committed buyers would ensure more dedicated improvements and stable growth for the future capital. Politically, he became an even more committed Federalist in retirement.
Really doubled down.
Yeah, vocally supporting the controversial Alien and Sedition Acts, and even convincing the formidable Federalist John Marshall to run for Congress to weaken the Jeffersonian hold on Virginia. Still involved behind the scenes.
Then, in 1798, French privateers, angered by the Jay Treaty and American neutrality, began seizing American ships, leading to an undeclared naval conflict known as the Quasi-War.
Right. Tensions with France boiled over.
Despite his retirement, Washington's sense of duty was undiminished. He wrote to Secretary of War James McHenry, offering to organize President Adams's army, an act of pure patriotism.
Couldn't stay away when the country needed him. Adams, without hesitation, nominated him for Lieutenant General Commission and once again Commander-in-Chief of the Armies on July 4, 1798.
Back in command, symbolically at least.
Right. He served as commanding general from July 13, 1798 until his death 17 months later. While he participated actively in planning the nation's defense, he wisely delegated active leadership to Alexander Hamilton, ensuring a capable hand was at the helm.
Smart move.
Fortunately, no army invaded the U.S., and Washington did not need to assume a field command. This final call to service, even in his twilight years and despite his profound desire for retirement, powerfully demonstrates his unwavering, lifelong commitment to the nation. It highlights how deeply intertwined his identity was with the fate of the American experiment.
He was known for a glorified facade of wealth and grandeur at Mount Vernon, a perception carefully cultivated. But the reality was that most of his considerable wealth was tied up in land and enslaved people, not readily available cash.
Land rich, cash poor, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
At his death in 1799, his estate was worth an estimated $780,000, and he held title to over 58,000 acres across various states, making him one of the wealthiest men in America.
And in modern terms,
his peak net worth has been estimated to be a staggering $587 million in 2020 dollars. A rich man, but often cash poor.
And his death. It serves as a stark reminder of the often brutal realities of 18th century medicine.
A very difficult end. On December 12, 1799, he conducted a strenuous 5-hour inspection of his farms on horseback in inclement weather, then dined with guests without changing into dry clothes.
Uh-oh. Recipe for getting sick.
Exactly. The next day, he had a sore throat, but was well enough to mark trees for cutting. However, early on December 14th, he awoke with an inflamed throat and severe difficulty breathing. In a tragically common practice of the time, he ordered his estate overseer, George Rawlins, to remove nearly a pint of his blood, hoping to relieve the ailment.
Bloodletting, oh dear.
Yeah. His longtime physician, Dr. James Craik, was summoned, followed by two other prominent doctors, Gustavus Richard Brown and Elisha C. Dick. Their diagnoses varied. Brown believed it was quinsy, a severe tonsillitis. Dick thought it a more serious, violent inflammation of the membranes of the throat, likely epiglottitis.
What did they do?
Tragically, they continued the prevalent but harmful practice of bloodletting, removing approximately 5 pints of his blood over the course of the day.
5 pints? That's a lot.
A huge amount. His condition only worsened. Dr. Dick, seeing the escalating crisis, proposed a tracheotomy, a procedure almost unheard of at the time, to open an airway, but the other physicians, unfamiliar with the procedure, disapproved.
So they stuck with the bloodletting.
They did. Washington, ever composed, eventually instructed Brown and Dick to leave the room, assuring his trusted Dr. Craik, "Doctor, I die hard, but I am not afraid to go." It's hard to imagine the pain and suffocation he must have been in.
Awful. On his deathbed, a final instruction. Fearing being entombed alive, a common fear of the era, he instructed his private secretary, Tobias Lear, to wait 3 days before his burial.
According to Lear, Washington died between 10 and 11 p.m. on December 14, 1799, with Martha at the foot of his bed. His last recorded words were, "Tis well."
Tis well. Such composure, even at the end.
His illness and cause of death remain subjects of medical debate. His doctor's published account cited Syncytia trachealis, a severe inflammation of the upper windpipe. Modern experts largely conclude he likely died from severe epiglottitis, an acute inflammation that obstructs the airway.
Which was tragically complicated by the very treatments intended to save him.
Exactly. Multiple doses of calomel, a powerful purgative, and extensive bloodletting, which likely led to hypovolemic shock. It's a poignant reminder of the limitations of 18th century medicine, even for the most revered figures.
His funeral was held just 4 days later, on December 18, 1799, at Mount Vernon. The procession included cavalry and foot soldiers, 6 colonels served as pallbearers, a testament to his military legacy. The service was restricted mostly to family and friends. Reverend Thomas Davis read a brief service, followed by a ceremony by members of Washington's Masonic Lodge, as he had been a devoted Freemason since 1752.
Word of his death spread slowly across the new nation. But as it did, church bells rang, businesses closed, and solemn memorial processions were held in major cities, reflecting the depth of national mourning. Martha, in a heartbreaking act to protect their privacy, burned her extensive correspondence with Washington.
Oh, what a loss for historians.
Huge loss. Though thankfully, 5 letters between them survived. This final period, where he transitions back to private life, only to be called to service yet again, highlights the deep, almost ingrained commitment he had to the nation, even as he was dealing with personal health issues and complex financial realities.
Washington was buried in the family vault at Mount Vernon, but his story didn't end there, did it?
No. His will included instructions for a new, more secure vault, which was completed in 1831.
Help keep our community safe and healthy during National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, October 25th. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent drug misuse before it starts.
After a disgruntled ex-employee attempted to steal his skull, a bizarre and macabre incident that underscored his enduring symbolic power.
Steal his skull. Good grief.
Yeah. In 1832, a congressional committee even debated moving his body to a crypt in the U.S. Capitol. But Southern opposition was intense, fearing division, and the idea of his remains ending up on a shore foreign to his native soil. It was a deeply symbolic struggle over national identity. Finally, on October 7, 1837, his remains, still in the original lead coffin, were reverently placed within a marble sarcophagus in the new vault. What's fascinating here is the almost immediate posthumous debate about his resting place, underscoring his profound symbolic importance even in death, reflecting early national anxieties about their unity and shared heritage. #, #, #, philosophy and views.
This section really humanizes him, doesn't it? We see a man wrestling with the profound moral questions of his time, deeply religious but not dogmatic, and a private individual behind the formidable public figure. His views on slavery, in particular, reveal a powerful internal conflict that developed over decades.
It's perhaps the most complex part of his story. During his lifetime, at least 577 enslaved people lived and worked at Mount Vernon. He inherited some, gained control of 84 dower slaves through his marriage to Martha, and personally purchased at least 71 slaves between 1752 and 1773. By 1799, he was even renting 40 slaves as part of an agreement for a neighboring estate. This was the deeply uncomfortable, pervasive reality of his life as a Virginia planter.
Absolutely. The evolution of his views on slavery, from an early economic necessity to a privately expressed moral opposition and eventual groundbreaking manumission in his will, is a critical lens through which to understand the revolutionary ideals themselves.
Slavery was undeniably deeply ingrained in Virginia's economy and social fabric, the very foundation of its wealth. Prior to the Revolutionary War, Washington's views largely matched most planters, primarily focusing on the economic contribution and management of enslaved labor. But starting in the 1760s, a profound shift began.
What prompted it?
His first doubts were surprisingly pragmatic, prompted by his transition from tobacco to grain crops. This diversification resulted in a costly surplus of enslaved labor, leading him to question the system's economic efficiency. In a telling 1778 letter, he expressed a desire to get quit of Negroes, revealing an early, if still economically driven, unease.
His disillusionment was further spurred by the powerful, liberty-affirming principles of the Revolution, principles that stood in stark contrast to the institution of slavery.
The inherent contradiction.
And by the influence of revolutionary friends like Lafayette and Hamilton, who were ardent abolitionists, most historians agree that the Revolution was central to his evolving attitudes, pushing him to confront the hypocrisy of fighting for freedom while owning human beings.
After 1783, having secured that freedom for the nation, he began to express inner tensions about the problem of slavery more frequently, though always in private. He was, it seems, deeply conflicted. As president, he famously remained publicly silent on the topic, believing correctly that it was a nationally divisive issue that could splinter the fragile Union, a political pragmatism that weighed heavily against his evolving personal morality.
He even gave moral support to Lafayette's bold plan to purchase land in the West Indies and free enslaved people there, a truly radical idea for the time. But Washington chose not to participate himself. illustrates the tension between his private conviction and his public actions.
Right. Privately, he expressed support for gradual emancipation to prominent Methodists Thomas Coke and Francis Asbury in 1785, but again, declined to sign their public petition, maintaining his cautious stance on public political action. By 1786, he clearly expressed a desire for slavery to end through a gradual legislative process, aligning him with the mainstream anti-slavery literature and thought of the time.
Ultimately, he emancipated 123 or 124 enslaved people, which was highly unusual and a profoundly significant act among large slaveholding Virginians, even though he remained dependent on enslaved labor for his farms until his death.
Based on his private papers and contemporary accounts, Washington slowly but surely developed a cautious sympathy toward abolitionism, culminating in his extraordinary will. This document freed his longtime valet, Billy Lee, immediately, and most significantly, freed the rest of his personally owned enslaved people upon Martha's death.
A truly unprecedented act for a Southern planter of his stature.
Absolutely. On January 1st, 1801, 1 year after his death, Martha Washington, citing security concerns and knowing her death would trigger their freedom, signed an order to free his slaves early. What's often overlooked is the complexity of this freedom. Many of the formerly enslaved were reluctant to leave, and others refused to abandon spouses or children who were still held as dower slaves by the Custis estate.
A heartbreaking reality of manumission, then.
It was. Funds from his will were wisely used to feed, clothe, and care for young, aged, and infirm formerly enslaved people until the early 1830s, showing a remarkable, if imperfect, commitment to their welfare. If we connect this to the bigger picture, Washington's evolving views and his ultimate act of manumission, while imperfect and delayed, show how the principles of liberty articulated in the Revolution, even if inconsistently applied, began to challenge the very foundations of colonial society. It's a powerful, if deeply complicated, legacy.
Beyond this, Washington was also a man of deep, if reserved, religious conviction. He was baptized as an infant in April 1732 and was a lifelong devoted member of the Anglican Church.
Right. Served over 20 years as a vestryman and church warden in Virginia parishes, positions of real authority and community standing. He privately prayed and read the Bible daily and publicly encouraged prayer. Interestingly, he may have taken communion regularly before the Revolution, but not afterwards, a personal shift that historians still debate the meaning of.
He often referred to God in the American Enlightenment terms of the era, didn't he? Using phrases like providence, the Almighty, and the divine author, rather than overtly evangelical language.
He did. He genuinely believed in a divine power that watched over battlefields, influenced war outcomes, protected his life, and was intimately involved in American politics and the miraculous creation of the United States. Ron Chernow notes Washington avoided evangelistic Christianity, hellfire and brimstone speech, and anything to flaunt his religiosity, adding, he never used his religion as a device for partisan purposes or in official undertakings.
But he knew his Bible.
Oh, absolutely. Washington frequently quoted or paraphrased the Bible and often referred to the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, showing a deep familiarity with scripture and liturgy. As president, he skillfully navigated the diverse religious landscape of the new nation. He acknowledged major religious sects, gave speeches advocating for religious toleration, and firmly opposed state religion, understanding the pluralistic nature of American society.
Embracing Enlightenment ideas.
He adopted Enlightenment ideas and values, reason, skepticism of dogma, but clearly harbored no contempt for organized Christianity. In a telling letter in 1793, he told members of the new church in Baltimore that light of truth and reason has triumphed over the power of bigotry and superstition. This balance between reason and faith is a hallmark of the era's enlightened leaders and a crucial aspect of his vision for a free society.
Freemasonry was also a significant part of his life, a fascinating layer to his public persona.
It was a widely accepted institution in the late 18th century, known for advocating moral teachings, philanthropy, and fraternal bonds. Importantly, American Masonic lodges did not share the anti-clerical views often associated with some European lodges. Here, it was seen as a pillar of community.
When did he join?
Washington was initiated as one of the first entered apprentices at a Fredericksburg, Virginia lodge in November 1752 at age 20. He rapidly became a master mason within a year, a testament to his character and intellectual curiosity. He was even recommended for Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Virginia in 1777, but did not assume the role, later proudly serving as the charter master of Alexandria Masonic Lodge No. 22 in 1788-1789, during the pivotal years leading up to his presidency.
Delving into his personal details and health also gives us a richer, more human picture. Reminds us he was a man of his time, with all the accompanying struggles.
Definitely. His 1751 bout with smallpox may have tragically rendered him sterile, or Martha may have sustained an injury during Patsy's birth. Regardless, the couple lamented not having children together. They poured their affections into Martha's children and later two of Jackie's children, and supported numerous nieces and nephews, illustrating their expansive family circle.
And there's that historical dispute over the paternity of West Ford, an enslaved man of his younger brother, with family oral history suggesting George Washington as the father, a sensitive and unresolved historical question.
A complex point, yes.
Mm.
Personality-wise, he was somewhat reserved, almost austere in public, but clearly commanded a strong presence. He wasn't known as a gifted orator or a passionate debater, preferring to let his actions speak louder than words.
Stoic.
Very. He drank alcohol in moderation, a stark contrast to some of his contemporaries, and was morally opposed to excessive drinking, smoking, gambling, and profanity. Embodied the virtues he hoped to instill in the new nation.
Physically, he was quite imposing, wasn't he? Taller than most contemporaries, standing between 6 feet and 6 feet, 3.5 inches, and known for his strength. He had gray-blue eyes and long reddish-brown hair, which he famously wore curled, powdered, and tied in a queue.
Not a wig.
Right. Not a powdered wig, as is often mistakenly thought. A subtle but important historical correction.
His health was a constant, often debilitating struggle that few truly appreciated. He suffered severe tooth decay throughout his life, eventually losing all but one tooth, which must have been agonizing.
Yeah.
He had several sets of famously not wooden false teeth. They were made of metal, ivory, bone, animal teeth, and possibly even human teeth, likely from enslaved individuals. A grim aspect of 18th century dentistry.
Unbelievable. The constant pain treated with laudanum, an opium-based tincture.
Yeah. He also endured a painful thigh growth early in his first term and a life-threatening bout of pneumonia in 1790, from which he never fully recovered. Despite these relentless ailments, he was an incredibly talented equestrian, described by Jefferson as the best horseman of his age. He collected thoroughbreds at Mount Vernon. His two favorite horses, Blueskin and Nelson, were legendary. It paints a picture of a man whose public stoicism often masked immense private suffering. #legacy.
What stands out to you in this complex look at his legacy? It's clear that he's deeply ingrained in the American consciousness, but the historical lens continually sharpens, revealing ever more layers of complexity.
It really does. George Washington is without a doubt one of the most influential figures in American history. Virginia's governor, Henry Lee, famously eulogized him as first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, a sentiment that has echoed through the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
He's consistently considered one of the greatest presidents in popular and scholarly polls, and internationally, he became a towering symbol for liberation and nationalism as the leader of the first successful revolution against the colonial empire, inspiring movements globally.
This discussion of his legacy truly shows that even foundational figures are subject to ongoing reevaluation, a crucial process for any nation. Washington's birthday was officially proclaimed a federal holiday in 1879, a testament to his early and enduring symbolic importance.
And in a unique posthumous honor, in 1976, during the American Bicentennial, he was appointed General of the Armies of the United States, with President Gerald Ford stating he would rank first among all officers of the Army, past and present. He was officially promoted by the Army on March 13, 1978. It's an extraordinary recognition that highlights his military supremacy in American history.
Early biographical narratives like Mason Locke Weems' hugely popular 1809 hagiographic biography played a massive role in shaping public perception. Weems aimed to humanize Washington, inspire patriotism and morality in the young republic, and in doing so, fostered enduring myths.
Like the cherry tree story.
Exactly, the famous cherry tree story, which, it's worth noting, remains entirely unproven. These stories, while inspiring, often simplified and even obscured the deeper complexities of the man, creating an almost unachievable ideal.
Indeed. In the 21st century, his reputation has rightly come under increasing critical scrutiny, moving beyond the hagiography to a more nuanced understanding. Historian John Ferling notes he's the only founder and president ever called godlike, and consequently, he's also the most scrutinized by historians, particularly in recent decades. David Hackett Fisher defined his character as encompassing integrity, self-discipline, courage, absolute honesty, resolve, and decision, but also forbearance, decency, and respect for others. That blend of admirable traits combined with the more complicated actions and views of his time is absolutely essential for a full and honest understanding of his place in history.
And his legacy, particularly regarding Native Americans and slavery, presents truly complex and often painful challenges that continue to be debated. On Native Americans, his legacy is decidedly mixed.
It's very mixed. Chernow states Washington consistently tried to be even-handed, hoping indigenous peoples would adopt agricultural communities like white settlers, and never advocated outright confiscation or forcible removal without compensation. By stark contrast, Colin G. Calloway argues Washington had a lifelong obsession with getting Indian land and initiated policies that had devastating effects, believing he had no choice but to extirpate them if they resisted. A chilling and brutal perspective.
It's a tension between his stated desires and the often brutal outcomes of his policies.
A huge tension. The stark contrast between the traditional, often idealized view and the critical scrutinies of the 21st century, especially concerning his profound and devastating impact on Native American populations and his slaveholding, is vital to acknowledge and grapple with. Along with other founding fathers, he has been, and continues to be, criticized for holding enslaved people. Despite his privately expressed desire for abolition and his groundbreaking will, he did not initiate or publicly support abolition initiatives during his presidency.
Which has led to calls to remove his name from public buildings and statues, forcing us to confront the uncomfortable truths of our origins.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it reminds us that national identity is a continuously negotiated space, and understanding historical figures requires embracing their full, often contradictory, humanity rather than sanitizing them for comfort.
His impact on American culture is, of course, absolutely undeniable, permeating nearly every aspect of our national life. His presidential library is housed at Mount Vernon, now a cherished National Historic Landmark. His vast and historically invaluable papers are held by the Library of Congress.
And so many places and monuments are named in his honor, including the very capital city itself, Washington, D.C., and the entire state of Washington, the only state named after a president.
His ubiquity is truly astonishing. The Washington Monument, a soaring 555-foot marble obelisk, stands proudly on the National Mall, dedicated in 1885. He appears as one of the four iconic presidents on Mount Rushmore.
The George Washington Bridge, opened in 1931, connects New York City to New Jersey. Numerous secondary schools and universities across the country, including prestigious institutions like George Washington University and Washington University in St. Louis, bear his name.
He appears on contemporary U.S. currency. The $1 bill, the presidential $1 coin, the quarter-dollar coin. He was even pictured on the nation's first postage stamp in 1847 and has appeared on more U.S. postage stamps than anyone else. His presence is truly woven into the very fabric of American visual and cultural identity. Hashtag, tag, 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 outro.
We've journeyed through the extraordinary life of George Washington, haven't we? From that young, ambitious colonial officer whose early blunders and humiliations profoundly shaped his resolve, to the indispensable leader who guided a fledgling nation through war and meticulously laid the foundations of its government.
Yeah, we've seen a figure of immense strength, strategic genius, and a deeply thoughtful individual grappling with the moral and practical challenges of his time, constantly learning and adapting.
He was undoubtedly a man of his era, shaped by its limitations and opportunities, but also someone whose views profoundly evolved, particularly on the deeply troubling institution of slavery, ultimately making a singular, groundbreaking statement through his will.
And his unwavering dedication to Republican ideals and, crucially, peaceful transitions of power set a course that resonates to this day, distinguishing America as a nation founded on democratic principles rather than military coups.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. Given Washington's evolving views on slavery and his eventual instruction for manumission, how might his ultimate vision for American liberty have continued to evolve if he had lived longer? And what does that suggest about the ongoing, unfinished work of defining and expanding freedom for all?
What can his journey, with all its triumphs and contradictions, teach us about the complex and often messy path of progress, both personal and national? Something to think about.